Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, we're talking with Jorge Garza. He's the Director of Technology for Univision Radio in McAllen, Texas. And Jorge was one of the very first adopters of audio over IP for broadcast. He's got some 15-year-old systems. We're going to check with Jorge and see what's going on. Plus, did you know that he's a hero? It's all coming up next on Twerked. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, savings, and support, online at bgs.cc. By the Ruby console from Lavo, see Lavo and your future at lavo.com/twert. By Angry Audio, audio problems disappear when you get angry at angryaudio.com. And by the Calrec Type R console system. Type R is a brand new, modular, expandable IP-based radio system from Calrec Audio. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech, the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. I'm here at the Telos Alliance studio in Nashville, Tennessee. Glad to be home. Made a quick trip up to Telos early this week and got some great training and met with some incredible engineers on the Infinity audio over IP intercom system. It's meant for television, radio, venues, live sound, theaters, all that kind of stuff. So we learned a lot about that, and you've probably heard about it here on Twerked before. So I think I'm good to go. I think I got it all figured out, and I'll let you know. So this is the show where we talk about all this radio stuff, and today we've got a really interesting look back, so that we can look at the present and maybe figure out the future. We'll get to our guest here in just a minute, but I want to introduce my co-host. He's here with us, as he almost always is. It's Chris Coben from New York. Hey, Chris, welcome in.
Hello, Kirk. Yep, it's we're going back to the early days of audio over IP. Wow, what a concept. What a thought. The fad that actually stayed with him.
Go ahead.
No, it's just a fad. You know, I was told it was a passing fad. The technology is unreliable and it'll never be, you know, what you think. And that's why we need to use this other stuff. And I was like, yeah, that's what you want to think. Have at it. I'm going this way.
And now it's just pretty ordinary. It's everywhere. And although plenty of engineers are still learning about it. And so we're going to hear from an engineer, a friend of mine. I met this guy, man, it's been 15 years ago, that I met this fella, and I met him, I think it was at a broadcaster show in Austin, Texas, but let's bring him in. Jorge Garza, he's the Director of Technology at Univision Radio in McAllen, Texas. Jorge, welcome in. Glad you're here.
Hey, Kirk. Thank you. Thank you for having me. And you and Chris, appreciate it very much.
And it's great to see you. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I think it was in NAB, either NAB or TAB in Texas that we met. So, yes, I remember it was NAB in Vegas.
We're going to hear this whole story, but you have been, to just kind of whet people's appetite, you've been using this technology, audio over IP. I mean, all of your radio stations in McAllen have been using this technology. You've been putting all your audio over blue Cat 5 cables or whatever color they are for 15 years now. That's amazing.
Yeah, that's right. 15 years. It's hard to believe, but I think every single piece of gear that we've installed, and I'm thinking it was either 2004 or 2005, is still on the air right now. We've taken a couple of pieces away that over the years we had to repair, and that was on my part that I did some soldering mistakes, but I believe most of it is still on the air and it's still working, and it's working great actually. So
you know what, during the break here, maybe you should try to use your calculator and calculate how many packets have passed through your Ethernet switches. That's a big number. Oh,
I don't think there's enough digits on the calculator.
We're gonna take our first break. This Week in Radio Tech, we're talking to Jorge Garza, and of course, Chris Toba is with us. I'm Kirk Harnack. We're gonna talk about 15 years of audio over IP, and I'm really curious to hear from Jorge as to 15 years ago, this was just a new technology. He was one of the first adopters of this, and I want to know what gave him the confidence to jump into this. This would be like, I don't know, the first person wiring a studio with AES-3 audio, digital audio. I'm not sure what to compare it to, but it's going to be interesting to hear from Jorge and then hear how it's been working for 15 years. Can't believe I'm that old. We'll be right back after this from Vox Pro.
Yo, what's up? Live from NAB 2018. Hey, it's Caden. You need to check out Wheatstone and Vox Pro 7.1. The upgrades are amazing. If you're a jock, if you're a talent, producer, whatever, a morning show, everyone knows Vox Pro. Everyone uses Vox Pro. Everyone loves Vox Pro. But now the features for this year, 2018, on 7.1 are amazing. If you're using version 4, 5, 6, and you go to 7, this is exactly what you're missing right here. The features are a game changer. It's going to cut down your editing time by like 80%, depending on what you use Vox Pro for. And with version 7.1, introducing unlimited Praktik button bars right here, hotkeys right here. I'm going to show you coming out of a song.
Bad things. It's a lot of bad things that they wish and wish and wish and wish.
So you're coming out of your song?
Yeah.
Start your next song right here. It's basically an entire production room right on Vox Pro. So it's the Vox Pro we know and love with a ton more features. And now this is the ultimate game changer right here. Effect macros. So instead of hitting your effects button bar and going up here using your mouse for every effect, you do it right here with one click of the mouse, and you're going to cut down your editing time by about 80% without even touching this new sexy black controller. Check it out right here, Wheatstone Vox Pro 7.1 at NAB in Vegas 2018.
And you can get Vox Pro and get a demo of Vox Pro by contacting Broadcasters General Store, BGS. They are a dealer for Vox Pro, and they're one of our sponsors here on This Week in Radio Tech. You can contact Broadcasters General Store, BGS, at by calling them. Pick up the phone and call them at 352-622-7700. 352-622-7700. Or go to the website. It's bgs.cc. Five little letters and a dot. bgs.cc. And give them a call. They're really friendly people. And they, you know, if you got a project going on, they will just, they'll follow the project through. I have seen some people from BGS on bigger projects show up and help unbox things. I don't know if they have time to do that for everybody, but I've seen it happen. They're really friendly and very committed to broadcasters at Broadcasters General Store. All right. Kirk Harnack, Chris Tobin, and Jorge Garza. Jorge's our guest, and we're going to jump right into this story. I got to set this up a little bit. We'll tell you what, we'll let Jorge set it up, because we were at a Texas Association of Broadcasters, TAB show, and we were showing the Axia Smart Surface. I'm guessing for the first time at TAB, as if, you know, the first time we had the Smart Surface at the TAB show in Austin, Texas. And, you know, they have this show in Texas in the middle of summer when it's really hot in Austin. I guess because the rent is cheaper on the convention center in the middle of summer. But that's I was there at the booth, and Jorge Garza shows up. And Jorge, tell us about the deal you made and what happened to this console at the end of the show. Oh, you're muted, buddy.
There you go.
Still muted. All there right, we go. Sorry. There we go. Okay. Go ahead.
Sorry about that. Yeah, yeah. And TAB was actually a little later after I had actually placed the order for the Smart Surface. And we placed an order for the Smart Surface after I saw it at the NAB. And that's where I met you. And we ordered the Smart Surface, and we ordered the, you know, nodes, analog node, digital node, everything basically for one studio. This was from one studio setup, the first one we did. And you told us, you told me actually that you were going to be at the TAB and that the Smart Surface was going to be there. So I drove over there, and it's actually that Smart Surface that you had there was my Smart Surface. So I went to pick it up, and I drove it back to McAllen, Texas in this big, in this pickup truck. And, it was in this big wooden crate, which I still have, by the way, at, one of our warehouses. It's still there. I swear it's still there. And, it was quite a piece when I brought it down, and there was a lot of people here when I opened it up, and they saw it. And it was this futuristic looking spaceship of a console, and it had no manual, by the way, no instructions. And that's where you came in, and you were nice enough to travel to McAllen and, you know, help me start this thing up and get it on the air. But yeah, that was the that was the surreal trip out there to go pick up a console that you had for the TAB show, which was mine.
Now, Chris Tobin has got his own stories to tell, and we'll get that in just a few minutes, but because Chris was an early adopter, too, of audio over IP technology. And back then, at that time, the only AOIP technology that was appropriate for broadcast, that is, had low latency and it was routable, was a technology that's now known as LiveWire, and kind of a precursor to what we now have, AES-67. But back then, you know, we had CobraNet and EtherSound, and those both, I believe, had way too much delay to be useful for broadcast. They were used for other things, for routing audio where delay didn't matter, and they weren't all that routable either. They were just transport devices. So, so back here, carry us back to 2005, we think it is, or 2004, whichever it is. I remember deplaning at the airport in McAllen and came over to meet you at the Univision Studios. Did we jump right into it and replace the console that night?
We did some pre-configuration, which I already had done myself, and you basically went over it and made sure that we had everything correct. And it took us about a day to do that. So I think you stayed at least 2 or 3 days, and you left at the third day, but we worked pretty much that entire day. And the next day during the night, that's when we actually put the station on the air with the console. I had measured the desk, and I had created a wire harness made out of Cat 5 cables. And I had, you know, put the end connectors on it, and basically had all the devices already in a spreadsheet and ready to be connected, and assigned all the IDs to it. And we ended up doing was just basically connecting everything, and you made sure that everything was properly configured at the very end. It was a pretty surreal deal. It was the first time I've ever done anything like that, so I learned a lot.
I remember it being pretty fast, and we had it going sometime in the early morning hours. And that the station that the first one that we replaced it on, I forget, was this an AM or an FM station?
No, this was an FM station. It was KBTQ, which was our hip hop station. So it fitted right into the format. You know, it was a nice futuristic looking, you know, piece of machinery, and the DJs were amazed in the morning. I think we started at around 12 midnight, and we finished before 4. So it took us more time to get all the wiring out from the furniture than it is to put it back in. And it's nice and clean to the day. It's still the same cabling, same wiring and everything.
Yeah, there's just not a whole lot of wiring. I mean, between the console and everything else, there's what, 2 cables, a power supply and an Ethernet.
Yeah, that's it. And just the cable running from, you know, your devices, we used to have their CD player and, you know, a computer. But now it's even our computers use IP drivers. So there's no wiring for them except for the Cat 5 going to the network card.
Well, let's ask Chris, see if what Chris's experience was. Because Chris is in a little different environment, New York City, where, I mean, we were off the air for 4 hours overnight from midnight to 4 a.m. in McAllen, Texas at KTBU. Chris, I'm not sure that you had that luxury of being off the air for 4 hours in market number one with when you did your first, or you converted Winds over to Axia. Tell me about how that process went.
Well, that was a fun process. First convincing folks that IP in general is going to do anything for us at the top station. That was the, you know, breadwinner for the entire corporation. So just to preface that, or context for everything. So yes, basically the meeting went as, yeah, you can install it, you can do what's needed, and however, we can't go off the air for this. I was like, okay, so how do we do this? We have 4 studios, 3 which are the primary rotation, and the 4th one is production. So I had to come up with a plan that was going to be, let's build the first one, which would be production. That would become the first air studio on the Axia LiveWire, IP audio, whatever you want to call it. And we'll begin the rotation of each studio offline one at a time while keeping the other two on. And the other one, it was wild. I had 6 months to do this in. And basically the conversation ended with, if this doesn't work the way you claim it is, you will be out of a job. And that's a quote. And I was like, okay, there's incentive.
Oh,
big risk.
Oh,
you know,
wow.
when you're working for the $70 million a year operation, and you're told that, and you've got 6 months to convert a facility of 24-hour news that operates every 22 minutes, and everybody short of 8 million people tune in and out to find out what's going on in the world and in their neighborhood and something. Yeah. You got to pretty much plan, really, really plan, mission critical. I felt like I was one of those guys at the, you know, mission control in Houston trying to figure out, okay, we just got the call. How do we put a guy on the moon? I don't know. We've never done it before. What do we do? So it was wild. But I have to say, prior to Axia Live Wire back in the day, I had already been dabbling, if you will, with audio over IP, with other products, software-based, and understanding the pitfalls of the technology and what it can and can't do based on, you know, how you deployed it, how you use the hardware. So looking at the LiveWire, and there was other products that we looked at, but LiveWire, I said, okay, this is the traditional way of putting Ethernet into a facility, right? We used Cisco switches at the time. That was the preferred, because I think HP wasn't 100% there yet as far as what I think was needed for LiveWire in the early days. Now it's changed. So looking at the Cisco deployment and what they recommended in best practices, I said, well, this is great. However, this is for an enterprise environment, office environment. We're in a radio facility. I can't have several switches working together in a virtual realm, if you will, virtual IPs in the event of a problem. One goes out, it takes all the others out with it because that's just how it was designed. So we had to come up with a plan, and each studio had its own switch, and we duplicated all the settings on each switch, had a fifth switch that was in the rack ready to go if there was a problem. And we built it out one studio at a time, building the switches, plugging them in, using the high-speed trunking between them. And we did not use the other method of trunking. Not trunking. Oh, there's a name for it. I can't think of it now. Creating a one master or virtual IP for five switches. Each switch had its own IP address. They were independent.
Yeah.
Which paid off in the end later on because the person we worked with, the technician from LiveWire Axia, what was his name? Mark Johnson. He came out.
Yeah.
He looked at our setup and goes, wait a minute, this is not the way we recommended. I said, yeah, I know. I said, but the way we're set up and how we operate, I can't use your method. We have to go to a different approach. So we literally, you know, threw the book out the window, you know, baby in the bathwater, out it went, and we came up with a new approach. And it worked. And then it took us less than 6 months, and we stayed on the air. And you can, to this day, when you talk to the news director, program director, and you ask them the question, did you ever have any problems implementing LiveWire? I think the line will be, you know what? We never had an issue, and we switched four studios, and we went through one election cycle and some other stuff. Breaking news, we had a couple of major events. And yeah, no, never hit a hiccup.
So breaking news, but no breaking studios. I think Jorge had a question for you. Didn't you, Jorge?
No, I was touching my eyebrow.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry. I thought Jorge was trying to interject.
Lessons learned, I will say this.
Yeah.
Lessons learned for everyone listening and watching. Plan out the system, whatever system you go with. It's just like building an RF transmitter plant. You always worked out the plumbing and understood, made sure everything was a certain way. With IP, audio over IP, video over IP, the combination of both over IP, plan it out, and you should have a very reliable setup now.
And even though we've had this technology around for 15 or more years, I want to say that if you're an engineer new to this, you don't have to go this alone. When Chris, you know, recommends, hey, plan this out, doesn't mean you got to get a piece of paper and scratch your head and figure out, now, how am I going to plan something I've never done before? The people at the companies who make this stuff, whether it's Axia or competitors to Axia, any of these people, they are only too happy to help you plan out and lay out. And even if you, hey, I need an IP address scheme, they're happy to, you know, get you point in the right direction on that topic too.
Yeah, I will say back in the day, Axia, the Axia folks, LiveWire, very, very responsive and were there with every possible chance to, you know, answer my questions. And we had a few come up, some questions I had, and they had a call. What was that guy's name? I guess he was the one writing the software, doing something. I'm not sure if Machi? He was back in Latvia. What was that?
Oh, was it, could it be Machi?
No, Machi. Yeah, I think it was. Yeah. We had some questions about, I had some questions about routing things, and Mark was like, well, you know, in theory you can do it. And there was another thing with the button pressing and how we use the on-off buttons on a console was slightly different than what he was accustomed to for the ticker. you know, the teletype ticker sound that you hear on 1010 Wins.
Oh yeah.
So we push the envelope, and I will say that the folks at the Axia division of the Telos Alliance stepped up to the plate and did a very nice job of being willing to listen and realize, okay, we get it. We're going to work it out and just bear with us while we figure out what we can do. And it worked. So I would say fast forward to today, if you're building a plant doing IP, definitely lean on the manufacturer and say, look, here's what I'm doing. Here's how we do it. It's revenue based what we're doing. So you need to work with me. And right now, I don't think you'd have any issue with anybody, whether it's Lavo, Calrec, Axia, Wheatnet, you know, all of them. I think you'd be fine.
Jorge,
one thing, Kirk. Yeah. One thing. Yeah. And Chris mentioned it, you know, that most of the facilities, they're 24/7. We don't have a lot of time to be down one studio. And in our situation, when you came down, we weren't totally off the air. We installed the automation system directly to the STL and routed it. And we had, you know, basically the automation playing directly without the studio in between. But with the Axia system, what's cool about it is that you can take your time and configure it the way you want it. And it's basically going to work the same as when you're going to install it on the air. So I did a couple of traditional setups where we had analog consoles or even digital consoles, and it would take us about a week to install the studio. So it was 1 week where they either were on the air with the automation by itself, or that they were transmitting from a smaller studio, maybe a production room with, you know, one or two mics. They didn't really have everything they needed. So it could be a week or two. In this case, it was just, basically, there was no downtime for the on-air studio, because in the morning, when the morning crew showed up at 6 a.m., the studio was already working. So all we had to do was train them for the new studio. So in this case, it's for anybody that's considering this and they have a short amount of time, or they don't want to be in a backup studio, you know, for more than a day, then, you know, this is a setup that they could consider, because, you know, in 4 hours, we were able to get the studio on the air. So there was basically no downtime for the crew when they showed up and they were on the air, and they had everything, all their microphones, their Vox Pro, the automation was installed and everything. So during the lab, the only downtime was really, it was for the actual studio. The station was not off the air during that time.
Yeah. You know, one of the questions that I've been asked by people when I'm installing a new console, and frankly, this is predated my days with Axia, which has been the past almost, you know, 15, 18 years or so. The question when a on-air talent comes into a new studio or a rebuilt studio, the question, you know, becomes, hey, how are we going to get training on the new console? And well, it's not that difficult. Well, you know, we need to get trained, and the program director, everybody needs to get trained. The general manager, everybody's going to need to get trained. And so they come in and we look at them, we show them, well, these are on off buttons and this is your fader up and down right here. And they end up saying, oh, it works just like our old console. Yeah, pretty much. Exactly. We show them a couple, hey, if you mess your console up, push this button to reload your profile and it'll reset the board to exactly the way it was, you know, the way it should be. So Jorge, did you have any training issues on your new consoles 15 years ago when you did this?
No, because like you're saying, it basically it was the same setup. You know, you had your program one, program two, volume, your fader, and on and off. So it was pretty straightforward. It was actually better for them, because you can, on the configuration, you could lock out any features that you didn't want anybody, you know, playing with or messing with it. They can take them off the air. So when we configured the console, we just configured to what their needs were. So anything else, they were pretty much locked out. And for me, it was a blessing, because it minimized the calls from where, hey, I'm not getting any audio, I can't record them with the Aux Pro, or they can't hear me on the phone, you know, those type of calls, because it was just, oh, you know, the back feed to the phone is off, or, you know, program three is off to the recorder. You know, those kind of deals, they basically stopped. So it was actually easier to use for the operators. And I guess it was a formality more than anything for the training. But it was easy. I mean, took 10, 15 minutes. Nobody complained, and they were back on. I mean, at no time. So it was a cool deal for me.
Hey, that brings up an interesting point about this idea of locking people out of being able to do stuff with an analog console or even traditional digital consoles. If there's a knob there, it's going to do something. And you know, on an analog console, if the knob is there, the function's brought out, you can't change it. And somebody can mess with it, and there's no way to just push a button and set everything right. So I've walked into a rock and roll station where I was the engineer. And I mean, I don't know how long, if this went on for hours or days or weeks, but one of the turntables was in the position of take the left channel and split it to both, because that knob was available on the console. So instead of being in the stereo position or the mono position, it was in the left position. And there was also a right position. Take the left, split it to both. Chris, at 1010 Wins, did you take the effort to lock a bunch of features out so people couldn't mess the console up? Or what was your philosophy about making things simple for the operator and making it idiot-proof?
Well, the format structure at Wins and the way we built the studios prior to the audio over IP, the consoles, which were Ward Beck consoles, were basically laid out and designed as on-off, fader-up, and then the remote selector for the various traffic news, sports, I mean, traffic, sports, weather, and stuff like that. There were no other features on it. You could press things, do stuff. You wouldn't, you know, the worst case is you just wouldn't turn your mic on. We moved to the Axia platform, and with the Element console, I pretty much mimicked the same thing. I did not turn on any features, nothing. It was basically on, off, fader up, and then there's the remote button panel selection for the different sources. And that was it. And we kept it straightforward because the anchors have to read the news uninterrupted. It's not like, think of it this way. You're a DJ on a music station. The music is your buffer. On an all news station like Wins, the anchor is the buffer. The anchor is always going. Mm. And when they stop for a commercial, that's sort of like when the DJ comes on between music. So yeah, you only had 1 or 2 minute breaks here and there. You could change and do stuff. So we had to build the layout of the console, so it was muscle memory. You just put your hands down and you knew exactly where to press buttons on and off, moving around. So yeah, we didn't have that that problem.
This is a little bit interesting because you mentioned muscle memory, and at a station like 1010 Wins, at least when you were there, and may still be this way, where you said before on the show that each of the control rooms was designed like a jet fighter cockpit, and everything could come right to hand where they needed it, and all the screens that they needed were right in front of them, and they had to be in the right places. Could a station like 1010 Wins operate with glass surfaces?
I think we actually talked about that concept back in, as we were doing the Axia deployment, and there was some talk of that, because believe it or not, Tony Masiello, that name some people may be like, oh wow, I haven't heard that, mm-hmm. who was at CBS, moved over to XM back in the early days when they first started out. He was actually working on a project at CBS. It was a glass console project. And the idea was to have just very straightforward, simple touchscreen action and mixing whatnot. I don't know what became of that project. I wasn't in that part of the division, but I remember talking to folks who told me about it when I was working at the building. And I was like, oh, wow, check that out. That's pretty cool. That was another IP thing that I was privy to and got a chance to look at and understand. But yes, it probably can. But the thing is, what we overlook sometimes is we take for granted tactile response, you know, when you're touching your fingers against the surface.
Yeah.
You got to have the haptic response, I guess is really what I should be saying. The haptic response is key. So if you do a glass console or you do a touchscreen or you move the mechanical stuff out and make it just a glass surface, you need some haptic response in that kind of environment, because your muscle memory is based on not only memory, what you envision in your brain, not looking, but how your fingers feel it. Like, think of a friend of mine who's been blind from birth. He taught me a lot of tricks about, you know, how to get through the day. And one of the things that he always used to tell me about is, but when he touches, his touch is not just a touch. It's translating what's going on at the fingertips. So think of that same thing. If you're an anchor and you're doing news, I'm sitting there, you know, 10:05, the news time, blah, blah, blah. And here's what's going on in the news, blah, blah, blah. I'm talking about it. I got to move my hand to the remote selector to get the upcoming sportscaster who's off site. You're feeling your way there, or you know stuff roughly. So you feel the square button. You know which one, 4 down. Oh, there I am. Try and do that on a glass surface. How do you do that?
Right. And I bet I got this feeling that we're going to get there. I heard this 10 years ago that our different military contractors were working on when you touch a screen, you can make little ridges and bumps and valleys with essentially little hairs on the screen. Now, I don't know if that'd be like touching a moldy shelf in an old refrigerator, or just what, but right. What would that be like to reach over and touch and feel little bumps? And so your hand would know where to go. But you know where we're, this is in the consumer world. So this is an iPhone that's got that little kicker right here on the home button. And if this is turned off, you push this home button, nothing happens. It feels like, wait a minute, there's nothing there. It's just flat. It doesn't go anywhere. And when it's turned on, it still doesn't go anywhere, but it kicks you, right? And I don't know if you can hear it or not, but it gives that little kickback. It makes you feel like you pushed a button down. And when you let go, it kicks back the other way, and it makes you feel like you let a physical button up. And in fact, the button's not going anywhere. So that's just absolutely amazing that can happen. I think I may have asked Siri to do something. Anyway, I wonder if we can go there with touchscreen technology, something like that. Go ahead.
Yeah. Funny you mentioned, I've been working with live audio reinforcement for a while, about 10 years already, doing live music for bands and things like that. And one of the tools that I use that I work with are iPads, basically. And a lot of these live venue consoles like Mackies and Soundcraft, they all have apps where you can load the faders on the iPad. You can basically walk around and do your monitors or do your front of house, adjust EQ settings, compression levels, whatever you want off of the iPad. And there is a big difference from using faders and using the iPad, of course, and you can't replace a feel on a regular fader. And I think that's never going to go away. Even if we do go to glass surfaces or touch surfaces, I think that they're going to have to embed this, some kind of fader into them at least, or use a combination of glass surfaces and faders for certain situations, like in broadcast. I know in live reinforcement, it's not so much needed, but I think in broadcast, it is.
Well, you got to remember, it's the application.
Yeah.
Remember the application. When you're looking at a console, a desk, if it's live reinforcement, recording, you're visually looking down and your brain is determining where you need to go. In broadcast environments that I just spoke of, whether it's news, sports, or anything fast-paced, and you're relying on muscle memory because you can, the glass console, the surface can't be flat, can't be sheer glass. It can't be just a clear surface. And even if you have haptic response, even if you have small cutouts on the glass, that's still not probably going to be the same. Because, try it. Go into your studio, sit down, look at it, get a snapshot in your brain, close your eyes and feel your way around. I bet you if you had a LCD screen, or say a tablet in front of you, and try the same thing with a tablet that has the faders on it, can you do it? That's what we were up against back in 2004 when we were talking about, well, what if we did this? What if this? How about we use a touchscreen? Because we were using touchscreens at the time for our automation for playing out commercials. We went to for our news automation. We were doing touchscreens, but we had to. The buttons I had to make very clear. That had to be the size of your thumb. That had to be the thumb size. So when you touch it, you can be somewhere in that square. We had software that the buttons of the radio buttons were so, they look cool graphically. Oh, that's a great graphic. But when you went to touch it, because you're just looking out of the side of your eyes, right? Peripheral vision for the touchscreen, it failed miserably. And when we worked with another company who wanted to replace the old automation system with their new automation system, the touchscreen was nothing near it. We forced them to change it to size of your thumb. So these are the things you have to take into account. You close your eyes and try and run the board. Close your eyes and try and run what you're doing. And you'll begin to realize, oh, what is that I'm feeling? And you open your eye and you're like, oh, that is the knob that I need. I didn't even realize that. It's wild when you start experimenting in that fashion. That's what we did way back.
Interestingly, many people, probably all three of us on this call, can operate one of these without looking at it, right? But they're all about the same. From high school, sure, I learned on a Selectric typewriter, but the layout was the same, and my fingers fall about the same place. And these are physical keys. They push. I've wanted to try a flat keyboard that was virtual, but haven't tried it. It's going to be interesting. Hey, we got to take a quick break. You are listening or watching This Week in Radio Tech, episode 450. We're going to get to a war story. Jorge promised us. So we're going to get to a war story. We're talking about 15-year-old installations of audio over IP. And then Jorge's case, it was Axia Livewire, and I helped him put it in 15 years ago at his first studio, and still working today. And they've added more studios. So it says it's been very trouble free, just a few repairs here and there. So pretty interesting. Hey, our show This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by Calrec. We'll be right back.
Type R is Calrec's first native IP based mixing console. It is fully AES-67 and NMOS ISO-4 and ISO-5 compatible as defined by SMPTE 2110. Connectivity via Cat5e utilizing COTS switches and power to the surface is supplied via standard PoE switches to minimize cabling. Its 2U core has integrated I/O, so you're instantly up and running, and it can power up to 3 independent mixing environments, each with their own separate DSP resources. Type R's surface is modular and expandable, consisting of 3 slimline panels, each of which are user-definable with layouts saved and recalled quickly between shows. It's available in 4 DSP packs, and as your station grows, larger packs can be added, making Type R the most flexible radio console you can buy. Find out more at calrec.com/twert.
And be sure to use that URL, calrec.com/twert. Let them know we sent you. It'll take you right to the cool stuff, Type R for radio. Hey, studio guests are only human, and humans cough and they sniff and clear their throats, even on the air. Cure this with Angry Audio's Guest Gizmo. Press the cough button and mute the mic. Every guest needs one of these. You know what else they need? Headphones, which is why each Guest Gizmo has a studio-quality headphone amp with individual volume control. Anything else? We've seen those mic arms, you know, with the built-in LED tallies. They're beautiful. But how do you light those up easily? Guest Gizmo does that too, illuminating the red light whenever the mic is hot. And installing the Guest Gizmo in your studio really couldn't be easier. You know what you need? That. A 2 3/4 inch hole saw and a steady hand. No router required. Your studio gets a very clean, custom appearance, and you get all the credit. Check out the Guest Gizmo and all your cool gadgets at angryaudio.com. That's angryaudio.com. And I kind of want to preview what's coming up from Angry Audio, but I dare not. We're not finished talking about it yet, but stay tuned for cool things from angryaudio.com. Thanks to both Calrec and Angry Audio for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right. It's Kirk and Chris, and we're talking with Jorge Garza, and Jorge is the director of technology at Univision Radio in McAllen, Texas. And Jorge was one of those guys who I still don't know why, but he said, hey, that audio over IP technology, we're going to put that in our radio station and we're going to depend on it 24/7. And I don't care that nobody else hardly is using it. I'm going to do it. That's the way it happened literally 15 years ago, or at least within a couple of months, it'll be 15 years ago. Jorge, I want to ask about your thought process. Were you scared? Were you nervous? Were you thinking, you know, if this doesn't work out, I could have a real problem with my boss? Tell me what your thought process was.
Yeah, well, we were in the market for replacing our legacy consoles. So when I went to NAB in Vegas, I guess it was 2003, probably 2004. When I saw the setup for Axia, for the smart surface, I felt right at home. Having an IT background, Cat5 cables, RJ45 cables, switches, hubs back then was, you know, all very familiar to me. So when people were saying, well, audio, you know, over IP, that's not proven, I didn't need to prove it. I knew it worked because of the fundamentals of networking. I know that this was the way it was going to go, because back then there was audio over IP for phones. So it was just a step up for audio over IP for broadcast or for live venues or for live reinforcement. So when I saw it, it just, you know, I felt at home. It was like, you know, this is exactly what I'm going to put into my my studios. And of course, there were some competitors that we were comparing. There was we had some Wheatstone I looked at and Logitech, and but they. The topology, the how Ethernet works was basically what made me, you know, decide for AXI. It was a switch, cables, Cat5 cables or Cat6, and consoles connected via into this network. And when I saw it, it just made sense to me. You know, it was a no brainer almost. You know, it was. And of course, you know, there was very competitive pricing also that I had to consider. But for me, it felt right.
You know, a lot of engineers are new to the concept of multicast, because in our daily IT lives, we don't typically deal with this idea of multicast. And I'm wondering if, you know, multicast is where we create a stream in our case, some audio device, could be an audio a video device on a network like that. But we give the stream an IP address that is out of our normal range. I mean, it's mm-hmm. within the whole IPv4 range, but typically it'll start with 239 dot something. And the cool thing about these are special streams. They go to the core switch. They may go through, you know, one or two switches on the edge, if you will, but they go to the core switch and they stop right there until somebody, some other device or the same device, requests that stream. Hey, I understand you have a stream. It's got this number. I'd like a copy of that, please. And so the switch sends it on. This was a brand new concept to people, and it took explaining this a lot of times, and I'm not sure I understood any better than what I just explained just now. But this is the key to not overloading a computer network, to only, you know, making streams go where they're supposed to go. And we ended up, you know, you end up not overloading any of the links on the stream. Jorge, was that did you understand it at that level, that point? Or did you just have a confidence that, hey, I've done VoIP phones, I've done other stuff, I know that if you do the networking right and if you operate it right, it's going to work. What was your mindset with regard to the particulars of the technology?
Yes, well, since in the early days, we used to work not so much with switches, but hubs. And hubs were, you know, they worked differently than switches, of course. You know, hubs were prone to flooding and they weren't up to the technology to do audio over IP. But as soon as the switches started appearing on the market and they started getting less expensive, you know, we were accessible to that technology. And of course, you know, multicasting and quality of service and all that came into play. And we were able to, thinking about how those services work and how those protocols work, I was pretty sure that if data networks were very robust and you can trust the data on it, you can also trust your audio on it. So my concern mostly was how the Ethernet switches will hold up over time more than anything. And that, more than anything, that means power supplies or power failures or anything like that. That was my concern, because most of the time in other places that I've done work for, the switches failed because of power supply issues, not so much the actual data transmitting a part of it. It was all power supply issues. So my concern was, okay, if I have a power supply issue, what can I do? And of course, you know, some of these Cisco switches, they got backup power supplies, or in our case, we had a backup core switch. So, and that basically was just mounted right below the actual switch, the main switch, so the core switch. So if we had a catastrophic failure, we just basically switch over the cables, which we didn't ever have to. So the backup switch for my first network is brand new still, never powered on. So,
and you know me, I'm Mr. Cheap. I buy my for my radio stations, I buy Cisco switches like on eBay for a tenth of what they cost new, but I always buy two of them. I put two of them in the rack. One of them's on you. They're both configured. They're both tested, ready to go. But yeah, the general manager at the stations knows, move all these cables over to here.
Yeah,
going to be okay.
That's how we have it here too.
So, Chris and I are eager to hear some kind of a war story from you. Now, you're there in McAllen, Texas, and this is way down deep south in Texas. How close are you to Brownsville, Texas?
About 35, 40 minutes.
Okay. So you're down south. This is one of the southernmost points of the U.S. It's hot there. I'm sure you get your fare of summertime, incredible heat there. You've got a really robust set of radio stations there. They're very popular and, you got great audiences. But surely you've got some stories to tell about what remote broadcasts or transmitter sites or heaven forbid a tower falling down or crazy stuff. What would you like to tell us about?
Oh yeah. Well, we actually have the number one, rated station here, 12 plus Hispanic and general audience. So it's quite important to be on the air and being the, you know, South Texas, we usually get, pretty heavy storms or hurricanes. And, off the top of my head, one of the, a war story that I can tell you was in Hurricane Dolly, which was a Category 3 hurricane that hit the valley, which is the valley is the McAllen, Mission, Brownsville area. That's what they call it. And we got a direct hit from Category 3 hurricane, which was a very slow-moving hurricane. And doing prep for hurricane season, we did a PM on one of the generators for KBTQ, which is the station that we installed the Axia gear for, the first station. And they did the PM, they changed the oil, they did everything they could as far as the preventive maintenance. And days later, we got a warning that we were going to get hit with a hurricane. So hurricane comes in, we're all on standby. We're actually here at the station. We're, you know, hunkered down, ready to take the hurricane, and the power goes out, and all the stations, my three stations, two go on generator and one doesn't, and it's this station that just had the PM done to it. So I'm thinking I can beat the hurricane, and I'm about in between Brownsville and the towers are in between Brownsville and McAllen. It's about a 40-minute drive. And I say, well, I can race over there, go check it, and then race back. And the hurricane just barely touching South Padre Island, which is right at the about 40 minutes away. So I race over to the tower, and by the time I get over there, it's, you know, winds are picking up, and it's getting really, really bad. So I get off and I can't find anything wrong with the generator, and the winds are picking up and I can't even keep the door open from the generator door. And it's just, you know, it's getting, you know, too dangerous for me to stay. So after trying to start it up and couldn't get it started up, power came back on somehow. I don't know. And the station came back on. So I decided not to proceed with troubleshooting the generator because it was getting really bad. So I start heading back to the studios, and on my way, it starts really bad. Now by this time, I'm already scared because I just passed a gas station and I saw the roof blow off of it, you know, and started to fly away. And it was kind of dangerous because it passed right over me. So I stopped on an overpass and I say, well, you know, maybe I'll stop here, you know, take a rest and see if it, you know, it stops for a bit and then I can, you know, start driving back. And I stay there for a little bit and, all of a sudden I see a car flying off of the overpass and landing about 20 feet away from my truck. This vehicle flew over the overpass, the expressway, and it landed with the tip in front, and it stayed for about 2 or 3 seconds, you know, deciding whether to go forward or backwards. Flipped. So it flipped, and it flipped over. So I just stood there in awe because I don't know what to do. And it started to smoke. So I just get off, and there were two people inside. They were basically passed out from the impact, I guess. And I started to pull one out. I pulled the driver out, and then I pulled the passenger out. And back then I was a little stronger than I am now. I managed to open the bed of my truck, and I put them in the bed of my truck. One of them had a broken leg, and they were just coming out of being, you know, and they were complaining that. So I called the emergency number, and I told them, hey, I need an ambulance. I'm here in this part and here. And the ambulance is coming. By the time I called, the streets were already getting flooded. And the ambulance shows up, and I'm glad they made it. And they loaded it to the ambulance, and they started to take off. But by the time they're starting to take off, here comes the news people from other stations. And, you know, I guess they heard over the radio or something, you know, their emergency there was an accident, and the car had fallen and it was flipped over. So they start the newscast live remote. They're under the bridge, and, you know, air blowing and, you know, ambulances and cops all over the place. And they start interviewing me. Oh, you know, what happened? And I start explaining. And right away I get a phone call, and it's my mom, and saying, hey, are you okay? I know you're working in La Feria, but a bridge just collapsed in La Feria, Texas. I go, no, mom, it's a car that fell. He says, is that your truck that's there in the news? I go, yeah, that's me. So she was actually tuning in at the same time they were doing the interview, and I just had finished, and my truck was in the background, and she recognized it. So I go, yeah, it was me. And what had happened was that there was a construction on that bridge, and there were some barrels that were expanding the road on the overpass. So the barrels blew off, and these people were coming, and they didn't know that the actual road ended. There was no more in a road, and there was no bridge. So it blew, and they just fell over, and there was another car following them behind them. And it was a couple of ladies with two kids, and they saw the car in front disappear. So they stopped. Otherwise, they would have also, you know, plunged over, and they probably would have fell on the other car on top, and it could have been a lot worse. But that was an experience.
That is amazing. I don't think we've heard a better story than that one, Chris. And Jorge, you saved lives. Well, I mean, they could have, you know, laid in there and bled to death. So good for you. Pulled them out of the car.
That was half of my experience. I actually got caught up in there. I got flooded in. I had to spend the night at a high school shelter there in La Feria. And I actually had to drive about 5 a.m. the next day. We're through all the flooded streets and everything. But, fortunately it all came out fine. So, but, that was one of the stories that happened while I was working for, you know, trying to get the station on the air. And after that, actually we didn't lose power. So it was kind of amazing, you know?
Wow.
Yeah. So it was an experience.
You know, the show already has a title I gave it, but a great alternative title would have been what you said, Jorge, I can beat the hurricane.
Oh, yeah.
It's like I can beat the freight train.
Yeah, no, crossing. I won't do that again.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Well, good thing you were there. So, I mean, those people, so have those people express some gratitude? I'm sure they would if they could.
You know, I never got their names. I never knew who they were. I just know that they were tourists. Actually, they were traveling to Mexico, and they were going through to Brownsville and cross over to Matamoros, which is the Mexican city next door. Yeah. So they were, I guess, they were shopping or something, and they got caught. They thought they could beat it too, just like me.
Wow. We've got one more thing for everybody on the show, and that is our tip of the week. Hopefully something from Chris, and I know we have something from Jorge, so we're going to be right back with our tip of the week right after this. You hang on.
There has probably never been a better time in history to buy a new radio mixing console. Today's consoles are more sophisticated than ever, with more features and functions than you can shake a stick at, but have you noticed how complicated they are? There's a sea of knobs and switches and displays and buttons. Some of them look like you might need a pilot's license to do your show. Well, a board doesn't have to be complicated to be powerful. Just look at the new Ruby mixing surface from Lavvo. The first thing you notice is how smooth and streamlined it is. Ruby has lots of cool tech, but what it doesn't have is that confusing ocean of buttons that clutter things up. Now, we all know that there are some console features the Jock only uses once in a while. So why dedicate controls to them? Ruby fixes this problem by moving those once-in-a-blue-moon controls to a touch-sensitive, customizable GUI that happily shares screen space with your other studio software, helping you fight control room clutter. Thanks to this design innovation, talent that use Ruby produce smoother shows with less errors. Controls that are used the most fall naturally to hand, while functions that rarely need adjustment are easily controlled with just a couple of clicks in the context-sensitive GUI. And Ruby has cool features you won't find on other boards, like AutoMix, an intelligent gain-writing function that guarantees the perfect mix for multi-mic morning shows and call-in segments. Dual-mode snapshots that instantly switch the motorized faders between on-air and production modes. And enough DSP and I/O options to make even your pro sound pals green with envy. And because quality is as important to Lavvo as it is to you, every console is proudly built to fanatically precise standards at Lavvo's own factory in Germany. If you're ready to declutter your control room, do yourself a favor. Check out the new Ruby and the other cool Lavvo radio tech at www.lawo.com/twert.
And there's that URL, lawo.com/twert. You go there, let them know that we sent you, and it'll take you right to the radio consoles and the radio stuff at lawo.com. Thanks to Lavvo for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. All right, time for some tips of the week, the part of the show that a lot of folks say, hey, I just hang around for that. So let's check in with Chris Tobin first. Chris, I'm going to catch you off guard, am I? You got a tip of the week for us?
Nope, not at all. Not at all. Well, you know, since we're talking audio over IP and those types of things, the tip of the week would be, if you're building out or currently have an audio IP system, you should take a look at your cable management. You should look back and see where your switches and consoles or desks are plugged in for utilities, for the mains. Is it on your generator circuit? Is it on the UPS circuit? If it is on a UPS circuit, is it a local UPS? And have you checked the battery status of that local UPS lately, whether it's in the racks or in the studio? Also, check on the switches themselves. You know, a lot of times we throw things in a rack, and sometimes literally throw it in the rack and just put it on top of another piece of equipment. Make sure the switches have at least one RU of space around them. I know a lot of times people, you know, manufacturers have these, you know, fanless. There's no fan. It's convection cooling. It doesn't require anything. I've had several pieces of equipment in the last several years where they claim you can stack it and there's no issue. And there's been temperature buildup. So I've been practicing one RU around most of the gear. Yes, it takes up, you lose a space. I get it. There's real estate issues in the racks. But let me tell you something. When you have equipment that starts getting hinky because of temperature, you know, overheating, you'll be chasing your tail for a while trying to figure out why it's not, where it's coming from. And I can tell you that many years ago, well, about 15 years ago now, we had in one of our studios PCs, computers in the cabinet, in the furniture of the studio. The cabinet furniture was not designed for any heat generating devices, so there were no vents on the doors. So the IT department put the stuff in there, unbeknownst to me and several others in the engineering department. And our automation system from time to time would just get funky. Things would just happen. You know, the computer would crash or the internet email machine would go berserk. I discovered the 450-watt BTUs coming out of the PC were going into the cabinet and going nowhere else. And so it was getting recirculated within the box. So these are things you got to look at and say, hey, check heat load and all the, it's simple stuff. It's overlooked. And don't use your hand to determine the temperature of a device. Go and invest in a Fluke IR thermometer, or there's a couple others out there, and measure the temperature and look at it and see if it's above what the manufacturer calls for. And speaking of Cisco switches, the mean time between failure of a typical Cisco switch is like 24 years. So if you're having failures or issues with your switches, maybe look at the environment you're putting them in.
It's your fault. Yes.
Well, I won't say it's your fault, but there are certain design methods that the manufacturers work with. And unless you're planning on putting this on a 22G F-16 jet fighter, then you're not going to subject yourself to it. You might want to check your racks and make sure everything is copacetic. Because you should be able to operate your racks or your studio furniture with some degree of, say, a 72 degree, 75 degree temperature in the room, and the equipment should still be able to function. Because if you look at the temperature specs, it's much higher. So if it doesn't, it's having an issue, it's really worth checking. I know it's subtle, and sometimes people, you don't need to do that. It's fine. It's got a forced air. Forced air devices, remember, there's an in and an out. The fan is creating high and low pressure. If the in is the same temperature going out, guess what? The box is not going to cool. Remember transmitters?
Hotter.
Remember Jeff, what Jeff says, right? What Jeff Walton says about that temperature difference? It applies to Cisco, HP, and Linksys switches too.
Ah, just as much as transmitters. Yeah. Yep. All right. Yep. Thanks, Chris. Good tips and good to remember. I've got a quick tip, and I'm going to maybe have more on this later on. I'm still investigating it. I'm just starting to use it. And that is for remote access. Like many of us, I use TeamViewer. I don't feel good about, let's just say I'm not excited about their payment model. And so, I use the free version here and there, but I found something that I like, so far, and that is called dwservice.net. dwservice.net. Now, it's a small company. It's one or two guys over in Italy. So I'm not sure, supposedly everything's encrypted and they don't know your stuff. We'd have to, we'll have to have some people vet that and see if it's true. But man, is it convenient. You install a little agent on your PC, Mac, or Linux box. They have agents. It's the agent that runs on the PC that you want to go remote control. And then everything else you do is in your browser. And you can also have the agent generate a long cryptic URL, and you can time limit that URL, and you can give that to somebody. Say, you need to get them into my computer. Let me generate you this URL, email it to them, and that URL will just get them a full screen of your computer. For if you put a time limit on it, it'll be time limited. So that's kind of interesting too. And you can. I've created some shares on my radio station's account with dwservice.net. It's a free account. And I've created some of my home stuff on from here at my place. And so in the end, what I have is the ability to share the radio station's ones on my account. And so what that means is that it's easy. It's just one screen, one login onto dwservice.net, and I have access to my computers, plus I have access to the computers that have been shared with me. The other, you can look at the screen. You can also, instead of looking at a full screen, you can just go get the stats on the computer, the temperature, the CPU usage, the network usage. You can also run what is essentially like a file explorer from your browser window. You can run a file explorer on the remote operating system. So there's a lot of interesting things to do there. dwservice.net. If you have comments about it, love to hear about it. But it's free. The guy who runs it says, hey, I may go to a Patreon model or a donation model. He's got a donation model right now. But interesting. All right. That's it for me. dwservice.net. Jorge, do you have a tip of the week you can leave our listeners with?
Yeah, of course. Something I've encountered being sometimes servicing other sites and within Univision is label your cables, because when somebody else goes and works on or tries to help you out, it makes everything very easy if your cables are labeled. I don't know how many sites I've been where everything was just plugged in and we have to trace the cables, which takes time, and especially in an emergency, you don't have time. You know, every second is precious. So label, either by labeling with the label maker or, with a pen, or even I use sometimes when I have small facilities or places where I don't have a label maker. I just basically put different colors. I always have a set of real thin tape, and it comes in different colors, red, green, blue, yellow. And I basically wrap a Cat5 cable, and I put maybe a color code, red, green, and blue is this, or red, green, or only green. And I could quickly identify any cable on the run. And this makes it, very easy to identify cables in studios or anything like that. And in an emergency, like I said, it's time matters. So always try to label your cabling, and even if you can, have a spreadsheet. I have a spreadsheet of all my switching devices and what each port is connected to, the cable, and where it goes. So I can always just consult my spreadsheet, and I see, you know, if I have an issue, I can always check the status of the port on the switch and see, you know, packets or history on that port and see if I'm having any issues. So it's always good to know where your cables are connected to.
I swear, between you and Chris Tobin, I'm going to have to label my cables at some point.
Yeah.
And put new batteries in my UPS and take some temperatures.
I think we all need to do that.
Yeah, we do. We do. Hey, we got to go. Chris Tobin, thank you for being with us. I appreciate you very much.
Oh, you're welcome. No problem.
And Jorge Garza from McAllen, Texas, the Director of Technology for Univision Radio in McAllen. Thank you very much, Jorge, for being with us. Great to hear you've got 15 years of use so far with your audio over IP system from Axia. So that's great. Thank you.
Still on the air. Thank you, Kirk.
All right. Hey, next week on the 4th of July, I don't think we're doing a show. Chris, unless you just feel like hosting it yourself, what do you think?
No, that's all right. It's 4th of July. Why should I ask people to step away from their holiday? That's wrong.
There you go. Okay. So we're going to skip next week on Thursday. I should ask Suncast. Suncast, okay for you if we skip next week? Yes or no?
Oh, that's fine.
Okay. We're going to skip next week. We'll be back in 2 weeks. And coming up in July, one of our guests is Bill Sufa. He's going to be with us, and we'll have plenty more guests as well. So thanks again to Jorge Garza, Chris Tobin. Thanks to Suncast, the producer of This Week in Radio Tech. And thanks to Andrew Zarian, the owner and founder of the GFQ Network. And thanks to you. Remember, the website is thisweekinradiotech.com. And we'll see you in 2 weeks on the show. Take care. Bye-bye, everybody.